You've heard AM, you've heard FM. Now, tune in to DM Radio, the world's longest-running show about data. Each week, host Eric Cavanaugh interviews the brightest minds in the world of information management. Want to be on a show? Send an email to info@dmradio.biz. Now, here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome back. Welcome back once again to the longest running show in the world about data. It's called DM Radio. Yes, indeed, your host here, Eric Cavanaugh, with an all-star cast, folks, truly international today. We've got Canada dialing in. We've got Austria dialing in. We have Silicon Valley via Argentina dialing in. So we're doing great today, folks. We're going to talk about all things IoT, the Internet of Things. What does that mean? Well, I've been tracking IoT for probably 7 or 8 years now. It's been going on even longer than that, but it really formalized as an industry 7 or 8 years ago and became a very big deal. But in manufacturing, they've had that kind of technology for probably 25 years, maybe 30 years, depending upon where you go. It stands for Internet of Things, and it's really about devices. So your phone is a thing. When you walk around with your phone, that's an edge device. So that's part of the IoT network, if you will. Some people don't view it that way, but your phone is a device and it's connected to the internet. So it's part of the IoT landscape. Lots and lots and lots of things are connected to these IoT architectures. You see it a lot, certainly in manufacturing. You see it a lot in oil and gas, quite frankly. You see it in all kinds of industries, cars, all these cars that are driving around, self-driving cars, they're certainly part of the IoT revolution. And what we're seeing these days is a lot of emphasis on really nailing down the infrastructure to collect, deliver, and then manage and analyze and persist that data. And that's really what it boils down to. You've got sensors out on the edge, like let's say in an oil rig or in your car or on your phone, sensors out there just capturing information. How hot is it? What does the sunlight look like? Basic stuff that someone needs to use to manage their environment. So that's why they're big on oil rigs, because as you can imagine, you can't have people there all the time. And if you have sensors monitoring different things, this is why it's been big in manufacturing, you'll know when some part is breaking or about to break, and you can get someone out there to fix it. So that's one use case, but there are lots and lots and lots of use cases. Certainly with advertising, when you go into a shopping mall now, and there's geospatial data being tracked about you walking around inside the facility, serving you up ads based upon where you are. So that's an IoT use case again. Lots and lots of things happening in the IoT space. We're going to learn all about that today and the different technologies used to get the job done. So again, you have the sensors, then you have to find some way to transmit that data from the sensor to some sort of marshalling area. Then typically from there to a cloud solution is very common. And then from the cloud solution down to some management environment where some person is sitting there watching what's happening and making decisions. And more we're going to have functionality, actual compute happening at the edge. So what does that mean? It could mean anything. For the retail use case, for example, you could notice that some product is really hot. You could have dynamic pricing on the product and then change what's happening on the store level in terms of the price dynamically. Everything can be done through the channels, which is really quite fascinating. So these are just some aspects of it. We're going to talk to the experts now. I've got Lucas Funes of Weebee on the line from Silicon Valley, but he's doing some very interesting things. Tell us a bit about your company, what you've built, and how you play into the IoT space. Lucas.
Hi, Eric. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm the CEO and co-founder at Weebee. What we build with Weebee is a no-code visual designer platform to accelerate the development and the deployment of IoT and industrial IoT solutions powered by artificial intelligence and computer vision. And so with this technology, you literally can deploy solutions and to solve a specific pain points on the customers and then grow from that on matter of hours instead of matter of months.
Yeah. Well, and so you talk about no code, low code. That's another very, very hot topic. In fact, we had a show just on low code, no code, I think two or three weeks ago, and it was very popular. We had a huge amount of interest in that show. And basically, what's cool is that we're at a place now where we can pull that stuff off. I mean, we've had that desire for low code, no code, really since the dawn of software applications, to be able to build together in a visual interface the functionality that you want. But now, with the power of computing as vast and as well understood as it is, this low-code, no-code stuff is pretty cool because, again, you don't need to know code to be able to stitch something together. So in your environment, what are the end users? What are they actually stitching together to make work? And then how does that actually happen?
So the end users wants to have the actionable insights in the palm of the hand. So understand that user application and then what they need to access in real time. And then the other users that build and scale that solution, and they just wants to connect and solve the problem in a canvas that they don't need to have a technical skill. So one of the challenge for the IoT to grow and really take off, and this is where it's starting, is that you need on the other platform or the other solution that are, you need to put engineer for 10 months for solving a specific problem. And it doesn't make any sense to, if someone in the world already built a piece of code, why you will need to rewrite it?
Right.
So doesn't make any sense. So the collective intelligence, so having that, someone did this algorithm or the other, let's reuse it. So you can drag and drop that technology. So what we find is that all enterprises knows how to solve a problem in a whiteboard. But then when it comes to the real world, they need to put engineers and more engineers to manage infrastructure like the edge, the devices, the cloud, the data storage, and all of that. And then by using the no code, they just can drag and drop the technology and then provision the devices and then extract the actionable insights and generate that part on the visualization or application as the user needs it in the, and get the insights on the moment they need it.
Yeah, and let's talk about, so you're referencing basically a code library, and this is nothing new either, right? In the world of enterprise computing, the beautiful thing about open source is that we can all leverage a code base that we know works, right? So that's a very hot topic, has been for now, you know, at least 20 years, certainly on the Linux side, but now in the data space, there are so many open source projects. In fact, Christian Lutz from CrateDB, that's the product, crate.io is the website, they're doing that very thing right now. So open source is really powerful. It's compelling in part because we know it works. Many eyes make few the errors, basically. But when you're talking about helping people not reinvent the wheel, how are you doing that? What have you done to sort of evangelize and marshal code in such a fashion that people don't have to reinvent the wheel?
Well, the architecture on the platform we build is that any users that generate an end user application or even a code or that a piece of no code solution, they can publish in an open marketplace and then the other enterprises can reuse it. So when, example, if someone in an agriculture on a farm detects an algorithm to detect to prevent an infection on the tea leaves, then you can reuse that algorithm. Or like in soy production, someone builds their computer vision algorithm to detect that and prevent a trash mortality, then you can reuse that. And then you don't need to be a data science expert on doing that. It's just, if you want to use that box by dragging and drop, and you use that functionality.
Huh, that's pretty cool. So how much, like roughly, I don't know, in terms of lines of code or functionality, I mean, how many users do you have to the platform now? How easy is it to get on there and to get rolling?
Well, we have a B2B enterprise software, and we have a more than 10 enterprises, large enterprises that use our software. And then they have many users, like in some enterprises, they have 100 or 1,000 users there. And then we support more than 700 device types and different protocols already that are built in. So you don't need to put engineers to onboard a new device or sensor from different technologies like LoRaWAN and LP1 with Narrowband IoT. And then we have a different application solutions and user applications for different use cases like factories, industry 4.0, smart agriculture, livestock and precision livestock with poultry and cattle management.
That's very cool stuff. And just real quick on that computer vision, just so people understand what that means, this is a whole space in artificial intelligence designed to allow computers and algorithms to understand what they're looking at. So you had a story before the show about the sows, these swine that will roll over and crush the little babies. And so what your software does is it lets someone see when that's happening and I guess take some action, right, to prod the sow, or how does that work?
Yes, that's an amazing use case, and you can see the power of by processing at the edge. So by using AI combining with a computer vision at the edge, so those cameras are like a human watching what is happening there. And the sow is here and the piglets are here, and when the sow wants to just rest, they crush the piglets, and you have like a no more than 30 seconds or 1 minute to just save them. And the way they are doing that to prevent the crash mortality, they hear the noise of the piglets because they start shouting. That's so bad. But then, so there is a person walking around the farm, and if they hear the sound, they go running to try to save the piglets. But the problem is that also the piglets are young in the first 3 days, and they play each other. So sometimes they are just shouting because they are playing. So when they go walking, running, and this is for real, to save one piglet, the other piglets on the other room, they die. So the camera that is when it's a real crash event in real time, turn on a siren at the edge, but also generates that alert for them to save that. There is between 7% and 15% of the piglets in the first 3 days dies on a swine production. That so imagine that the impact for the climate change,
sure,
the animal wellness, and that's so hard.
Oh, little piglets, they're so cute. We want to save little piglets everywhere. I never thought I would be on an IoT show learning about saving piglets, but that is very cool. Lucas Funes of Weeby will stick around for the roundtable. Let's bring in Victor Volison to the conversation here. Victor, tell us a bit about yourself and what you're doing at Pervises.
So we build software-defined radios for mission-critical infrastructure, and that's basically a fancy way of saying that we allow software applications to talk to wireless signals and wireless products.
This is cool stuff. So you're kind of like the range extenders, if you will, for IoT devices, right? I think a lot of people know what a range extender is now. You've got your Wi-Fi, maybe you have a big house, wherever that router is, it doesn't quite get to that far room, the basement, the attic, whatever. So you put on a little extender and it grabs the signal from the mothership basically and delivers it to you. And that's kind of the role you're playing, is that your software-defined radio devices can pull in a signal from one place and push it back out in a different direction, right?
Absolutely. And not only can we do that, we can also hook up to core internets. So for example, like a base station connects to the telecommunications network, we can also kind of bridge that last mile, if it's a farmer's field or an oil rig, from their local network to the actual device itself, regardless of what protocol or what kind of language that device is speaking.
That's pretty cool. So what goes into these things? I mean, they're obviously they have transmitters and they have receivers and so forth. What is it? What is the stack of technology inside the individual radios do?
So it basically comes down to digitizing the signal, right? So listening for whatever the device is sending, we can then decode it or provide the raw signal data to the end application or to wherever you'd like to store it. Similarly, if the application or the edge compute device would like to do some logic or some user-defined functionality, we can then transmit a reply from that device. Or similarly, we can enable the application itself to say, hey, I'd like to send this data to the device, and we handle the really low-level protocol, the actual transmission on a particular frequency and particular band.
That's interesting because the frequencies matter, right? Like where you're actually broadcasting, that matters. I've been wondering, we kind of talked about this before the show, how sophisticated the industry is getting in terms of nailing down specific frequencies at which certain things broadcast. Obviously, in the broadcast world, is what we do. It's how you get to 104.1 versus 102.9, basically on your dial and your FM dial. That's what's going on there. But then also just like a library of devices and of assets and which protocols they use. How mature is that part of the industry now, and where do you see it going, Victor?
That's a, like, as I mentioned earlier, that's a really complex question. There isn't really a single library. Obviously, a lot of different vendors come up with their own algorithms or their own protocols for how to transmit data from point A to point B. And the design decisions that are used in terms of implementing a particular protocol for a particular device often depend on the use case. So for industrial applications where reliability might be paramount and where power consumption isn't necessarily a factor, you might go with one protocol. Whereas if it's wearable or if it's something that's really lightweight, you might go with something in which you might sacrifice performance or distance in favor of power consumption. So there's a lot of different kind of factors. And in the same way that people don't really think of the low-level protocol when they use the internet or things like that, we kind of abstract that away in a similar manner. So we kind of, if we do our job properly, amusingly enough, nobody knows that we're there because the application just works, right? Hmm. On the other hand, kind of like how the internet is actually fairly complicated once you dig down into it, it's about providing that meaningful level of abstraction.
Yeah, that's interesting. And this is the kind of thing that you usually see some organization sit on top of and manage, like a standards organization, for example. I mean, we have lots of them out there already. Is there a maturing organization now that's focused on standardizing some of these protocols and evangelizing and all that fun stuff?
I would suggest that there's many organizations that are doing it. Like I said, there are a lot of competing interests in terms right. of what you're optimizing for. I think before the show, Lucas was even talking about Sparkplug or MQQT, those kind of protocols. Those might be really good for certain applications, whereas others might benefit from a totally different protocol, right? And that's kind of the problem. The Internet of Things means a lot to a lot of different people, right? And making sense of the trade-offs often is really application specific. So what our product does is, again, it allows us to abstract that away and says, hey, with this one box, you don't have to worry what the protocol is. Your box can support all of it, right, through software, which is a pretty powerful concept.
Yeah, no, I love that. So, I mean, you're talking about, there was a great quote I had on a webinar, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago that I'll never forget. It's brilliant because one of the guys just said, oh, yeah, that's an old aphorism in the technology space, is one more layer of abstraction can solve all problems, right? If you can tackle enough functionality at that node, at that sort of marshalling area for functionality or whatever it is, data processing, et cetera, you've done something very impressive. And it sounds like that's exactly what you guys have done. That's a pretty big deal. So folks, we've talked so far to Lucas Funes of Weebee and Victor Volison from Pervises. Coming up next, we've got, Christian Lutz from Crate.io, CrateDB. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to DM Radio. Here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
All right, folks. Back here on DM Radio, talking all things IoT. Of course, the Internet of Things is what we're talking about. We're already having a fantastic show here. We talked to Lucas Funes from Weebee. That's W-E-E-B-E, I think. If not, yes. I'll have him correct me. Yeah. And yes. Victor Volison was from Pervises, just talking about what those folks do. And let's just quickly dive back into this whole concept of a layer of abstraction, of an intermediary device that is software-defined, and thus, over time, can understand, I'm guessing, more and more signals from more and more devices, and you have some sort of catalog of those, and then it can translate it and then transmit to more and more devices on this side. So it's like it's a versatile range extender of sorts. Is that about right, Victor?
Yeah, that's a really good analogy. It's basically a universal router, and we can get information from one device through another wired network or to another wireless device.
Hmm. And does it broadcast in analog? Are you actually broadcasting like across some frequency in the landscape?
So basically what we do is we take the analog wireless signals, right? Mm-hmm. And then we can process them, decode them. And if the information is digitally encoded within that signal or within that protocol, we can extract that information and then we can either repackage it maybe into a different form for wireless transmission or over another antenna, or we can just send that payload, that digital data, to another application or to the network for processing by a host application.
Okay, and is your input all analog or do you do analog and digital input?
So we basically don't really care whether it's analog or digital. We have a radio front end, so obviously anything that's wireless and anything that's transmitted over the air comes mm-hmm. in an analog form, right? It hits the antenna and then we have to basically process it and we digitize it. And that's where that conversion happens. And then we down convert it, so we bring the frequency lower, we do amplification, we do some sample rate stuff, and then we basically can extract the data or just send that raw data to an application where it can do it.
That's very cool stuff. It's a cool little niche that you carved out for yourself. I think it's going to be really, really important as time goes forward. And without further ado, let's get our last guest waiting patiently in the wings, Christian Lutz out there from Crate. CrateDB is the technology. It's a database for IoT, and crate.io is the website. Christian, tell us about Crate and kind of where you fit into this picture, because we talked about kind of capturing it, then moving it along, and then at some point you have to persist all that stuff, right? And that's what you guys do. Tell us about Crate and how you built it.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me. Yeah, exactly. In the end, you want to do something with the data and extract value of it, or as Lucas just said, you have to push triggers and you have to take action. And we built a SQL database that is purpose-built for machine data. Machine data essentially being a mix of structured data, relational data, and semi-structured data like JSON documents. And essentially, I'm one of the founders and president of Crate, and my co-founder and CTO, he worked like many years on building large-scale open source-based data backends. And with the rise of back then in 2012, Elasticsearch and the simplicity of how you can scale a persistence in a SQL database, this was really the idea that we had to build something that just any SQL developer can do. And SQL is the lingua franca in the world for data management. And now you can just scale from a few nodes to hundreds nodes, from 1 terabyte to petabyte if you want, and just keep one engine. That was the whole idea.
Yeah, what's interesting here too, and I'm a huge proponent of open source software, and that's been going on, like I said, for over 20 years now, that Linus Torvalds threw down the gauntlet, basically challenging Microsoft. Right. And the way I describe it to people is that, you have source code. Traditionally in the old days, it was closed source, meaning they wouldn't reveal to the larger world out there what the code was. Then you'd compile that code to run in a certain environment, like in Windows or now iOS or whatever the operating system is. Well, open source, of course, the source is open and anyone can look at it. There's a lot of good reasons for that. One is that bad code goes away eventually. I think one of the downsides is that there is a sort of limit, meaning it'll get to be just good enough, and that's kind of where it stays. And then you have companies sitting on top of that to harness it, make it, harden it, as they describe, so it's enterprise caliber. But the whole movement of open source is kind of what we brought in to the conversation with Lucas earlier, is you don't have to reinvent the wheel. And if everyone is always reinventing wheels, That just takes a lot of time and energy and money out of the equation. You can't get functionality very quickly. So the more we embrace open source as a foundational technology, the better off we're all going to be. Right, Christian?
Yeah, and we wouldn't exist without open source. It's very easy. The undertaking of building a database is just huge. You know, you couldn't do that. So we're standing really on the shoulders of some huge, giant, very successful and very well-established open source projects like Lucene for the indexing and the database, and Elasticsearch for sharding, and Netty for communication, and a lot of tools. And these libraries are all wrapped together, and we really added our juice on top, which is a distributed SQL query engine, so you can do real-time analytics at scale. And for the user, it's still just a simple Docker container. They can do a Docker run, create, enter, and it's installed. And the complexity that you really have, you know, summarized so much know-how and code into one library in the end. And there are other companies that are building on top of us, since we're a data layer, a lot of applications, and we have a permissive license with Apache 2. So people build that into their solution, into their stacks.
Yeah, that's so cool. I mean, this is what is fundamentally different now about the software world than it was certainly 20 years ago, but even 10 years ago, because now you have this critical mass of effort and all these libraries, these code libraries that you can rely upon. And as you know, Christian, it's still very complicated, even though you're using the component parts that are open source. Nonetheless, building on top of that requires a lot of effort. And everything I hear from developers says that when you start working in these scale-out architectures or hyperscale, as they talk about for the big guys, there's a whole new set of problems that's going to arise that requires a whole new lens of troubleshooting to be able to understand. So it's not like they're just Lego blocks that you piece together. You really do have to sort it all out. But the higher you build that mountain that we can all stand on, the more precise that companies can get about how they leverage those technologies. And that's where the value comes to the business, right? When you can hack through massive amounts of data and then deliver to the end user the ability to see what's happening, where all these widgets are, which ones are working, which aren't. I mean, it's amazing that all sorts of technology can then leverage that, like Splunk, for example, which, you know, who would have thought that a company could come along and do that and become so successful? But it's very powerful. It's very useful. And so all these different companies can now collaborate in the cloud to build amazing new scale out cool widgets to do all kinds of things. Right, Christian?
Yeah, it's a really interesting evolution. And, you know, we consider ourselves to be part of what's called the modern data stack, which are truly open source companies that together have their very clear position in this stack and enable these things. And I mean, we had long an open core model with an enterprise feature set on top. And this is what we thought is going to be monetized. And we just learned that actually the monetization is happening through us providing a service in the cloud to our customers, and not let's say the old school way of taking away a feature. And if you're
right,
put in a coin, then this feature works or not. Also because this has so much evolved, and there is this like very hard distinction of, well, this is an enterprise feature and this is the little developer who doesn't need that. It's no longer true. Just look at security. Everybody needs security. So you cannot differentiate through offering authentication and encryption, but not for the others. That's not a valuable proposition anymore. And this is really the big change that has happened. And at the same time, it's a fantastic opportunity to leverage for us as a service. You know, you can go on Azure or Amazon or soon also on Google and just spin up a node and pay as you go and just utilize whatever you want. You start small, and our largest customer in the US is McAfee. They run hundreds of nodes and it's huge what they do. And they also started very small. So that's pretty awesome.
Well, you bring up a really good point, and I'll throw one more question at you, then we'll go to the round table. But what you're talking about is really important, and it's kind of the other shoe finally dropping, I would say, on open source, because at a certain point, it's like, all right, well, how are you going to make money from this, right? And you see across the whole spectrum of technology today, all of these services that have been spun up. Facebook, of course, is free, which means that, you know, you're the one providing the data that they're selling to someone else. Even Google with Gmail, all these things that are free for consumers, well, there's some monetization strategy somewhere, and it's been a bit of a moving target now in the open source world. If you look at you talk about data platform, like Cloudera and Hortonworks and these big guys that came along, they were going to do that. Well, Cloudera, if you remember, their whole monetization strategy was Impala being some replacement for data warehouse or analytics or whatever. And then ultimately that didn't work, and they open sourced that. Like, okay, well, so what are you making your money on now? And it was services, it was building things, but even that is a bit of a commodity if you think about how many developers are out there in the world that could build stuff for you. So you kind of have to figure out what is it that's going to make you money. And I think you guys nailed it. It's really in providing this service. So it's, yes, the code is all open source that you could go build yourself if you want to. It's hard to do that. It takes a lot of time and effort. So if someone can do that for you, that becomes a very useful service. And that's what you're figuring out, right? Is you're getting money from your clients to take that task off their hands and give them a working solution that they can then do cool things with their company, right?
Yeah. So I just recently listened to a very cool interview with Steve Jobs when Apple bought Next in 97. You know, this is quite a while ago. And he was just perfectly describing with his new operating system where they said, you know, all this standard stuff that you do all and over again as a developer, that's part of the operating system now. And you as a developer focus on the delta, on this very unique thing that you know better than anybody else. And this is what you really focus on. And this is also where even a small team, you know, even a handful of developers, you can compete with a large corporation, because they don't have hundreds of people doing that. In the end, it comes down to a few people that focus on a very specific problem. And I think that's the opportunity that open source unlocks for everybody.
Yeah, that's great stuff. I'll bring Lucas back in to comment on that. Lucas Funes from Weeby. We really are, I think, at a critical stage in the maturation of open source as a mindset, as a way of building software. And I think we're beyond, hopefully beyond the point of no return, but you never know. Amazon has been knocked a few times for not being very open source. Google is and isn't, and different depending on time of day and who you talk to. Microsoft, kind of the same. But what do you think about open source as a prevailing wind in enterprise software development, Lucas?
So it is open source is accelerating many enterprise deployments, and it's definitely one of the ways to go. Like Kubernetes in the infrastructure side was started by Google guys, and then it was launched open source. And Kubernetes is today what it is due to be open source. And then now you can find those Kubernetes that are for deployment in different pods in AWS and in everywhere, and to orchestrate the pods. So that's a key component. But the other thing that is important is about security, because in sometimes when, if the open source is so the software is there, security is very important for the enterprise size as well. So there are some perspectives that says that open source will generate risk on security. I believe that is the other way around, because it can also provide the vision for different developers or that can see a bug hole or some holes on the security aspect on the different software.
Yeah, that's interesting. And we got about a minute left before break. So I'll just tell our audience, we want to know what you want to know. Send me an email, info@dmradio.biz. If you want to be on the show sometime, we're mapping out the second half of the year right now. It's info@dmradio.biz. And I have to say, I think in terms of security, what a sticky wicket, as they say. It's a very difficult thing. It's a very difficult nut to crack. I don't think it's ever going to be completely cracked. We actually talked with some pretty clever guys from Israel, in fact, just the other day about security, and they have a whole whitelist approach, basically. But it's sort of a zero trust architecture by default. And then once you get whitelisted, they let you do what you want as long as you don't do something strange. And if you do something strange, that's when they kind of take a hard look at you and do a whole security review. And that's an ongoing battle that, again, is never going to go away. It's never going to be solved. There's always going to be jobs in that space. But we'll be right back, folks. You're listening to DM Radio.
Welcome back to DM Radio. Here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
All right, folks, back here on DM Radio. Back here on DM Radio, talking all about IoT, the Internet of Things, and all the different devices in between. We've got Victor Volison on the line here from Pervises, along with Lucas Funes of Weeby and Christian Lutz of Crate, crate.io. I'll throw it back to you, Victor. I joked earlier, I think, about how one layer of abstraction can solve all the world's problems in IT. And it seems to me you guys are pretty squarely in that space, but by the same token, you always have to focus and stay focused on what you're delivering for your customers. So how do you guys do that? How do you balance? Because, you know, resources are limited. How do you know where to focus your attention? What do you work on? Like, what's in the roadmap for you? How are you doing all that?
So the thing about abstraction and about these technologies is that at the end of the day, the implementation is actually, in some cases, fairly complicated, right? Like making these devices, everything from manufacturing to designing them, it really takes a larger number of people, right? It's actually intrinsically complex technology. So what we kind of do is we allow people not to worry about sticking to a particular standard. We provide a lot of flexibility in that regard. And the kind of key thing that we do is the bet we're making isn't on a particular protocol or a particular method to or format to communicate to those wireless devices. It's on making it really easy for software devices to take signals from any kind of device, right? And that's kind of the abstraction there, is that the front end, the tuning, the product itself is all software controlled.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'll bring Christian Lutz back into the picture as well, just to kind of round out our understanding of what's going on here. Christian, you guys are again focused on the persistence layer, on pulling in all this information and then being able to allow companies to store it at least temporarily and then do something with it. What's the life cycle of that data typically? Do you pull it in, manage it, and then let it go? Or do you see companies persisting historical data in this space? What does that all look like?
Oh, that really depends on the use case. So we definitely persist data. So people usually operate hot on the data, and the retention times depend and vary. So for example, as I mentioned, McAfee is our largest customer. They run billions of rows per day. So they keep a few weeks essentially of hot data, and then they move it to a colder store. On the other hand, we have one of the world's leading energy drink maker with sensor data from the production of the cans, and they just want to have all the data all the time hot. So this is piling up over time, and they simply want to be able to do data science on all of the data, and they are accumulating now already a few years. So you will see always a mix of that, and going forward for data management technology like us to make this transition of data between hot, warm, and cold as seamless as possible, mm-hmm. without like these traditional ETL loading jobs and dropping data, loading data, but really to make a query interface that goes on a cold store where it's naturally then slow, but still you use the same API, you use the same technology to query it, as well as super hot data, which is in the milliseconds available, and to make that easy to handle through a SQL interface, ideally, that's the holy grail here.
Yeah, and what's interesting too is that, and we talked about this earlier today, is everything is changing so quickly in terms of what you can do with data at which point in time. It used to be 10 to 30 years ago that all that stuff would go through a data warehouse. If it were really important, multiple groups wanted to use it, you would pull it all in, persist it, or data warehouse in some relational technology like Teradata, for example, and then analyze that persisted data. Well, now with streaming data, you guys, as you suggest, people can just tap into this hot data to see what's where. And just to kind of explain to our audience why that would matter, well, certainly in logistics and consumer and packaged goods, when you have lots and lots and lots of small objects that you're selling, like drinks, for example, there are so many ways that you can optimize your costs, your delivery mechanisms, whom you pay, how much money, at what point to move it here, to move it there, to understand the demand in this location versus that location. That's the kind of thing that you're enabling, right, for a customer like that, is to really put together the whole big picture for who wants the product at what point in time, how is best to get there, all that kind of fun stuff, right, Christian?
Yeah, I can give you an easy example for that. One of our customers, they're producing plastic bottles, rigid plastic packaging, and they have to optimize the weight of the plastic in the bottle they produce. So they want to have, they have a tolerance band, an upper and a lower tolerance band of weight where they have to be in there. And the safest thing is to stay in the middle, of course, so they can react when it goes out, up and down. But what they want from a commercial point of view is to serve as low as possible to the lower boundary. And then they need a very reliable prediction engine that consumes a lot of data to make sure that they don't go out of tolerance, but at the same time really serve this lower boundary. And this you can only do with data-driven manufacturing.
That's so fascinating. I just love it. I think about all the use cases myself, and I'll bring Lucas back in from Weebee. I think the more people understand what's possible, the more they realize what the component parts are that can stitch this stuff together, the more you will see use of these technologies, right? Lucas, where do you focus on? I guess that's one question for you is, how do you market your products? Who are you talking to? Is it to manufacturers or who are your typical clients?
Our platform can be used for different industry verticals, but our main focus is the food, beverage, and agriculture industry. And also we have a different customers in gas and oil industry and then another manufacturing type processes. In that part on the food, beverage, and agriculture, we are focused on at the beginning on the supply chain that is on the like in agriculture and also in the manufacturing side. The way we approach the market is something that we believe that the digital transformation will not happen from the top-down approach. That is all the enterprises are trying to do that. It's like okay, let's connect all the PLCs of that and have the data. And then they have terabytes of data and then, oh, and now they don't have any meaning on that. So what we believe is that even in those spaces, we believe in the bottom-up approach. So the maintenance manager doesn't have the same problem that the production manager or the other in the general plant manager. So by having a no-code solution builder, they can really tackle on the pain point and then start aggregating and building the digital transformation from the bottom-up approach. There are many enterprises that invested millions of dollars and they just have a raw data without a meaning. And then they say, okay, let's put data science and make sense of all the investment to get some insight. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think this is why I get back to standards organizations and conferences whenever they come back, obviously, but I'll bring in Victor quickly to kind of share some thoughts about that. We've got about a minute, well, 2 minutes left before the live show is over. But there's a lot of education that needs to happen, Victor, and it's hard because you have thousands of vendors all speaking their own truth and putting their own marketing messaging out there. But I do think that the need for these technologies is going to drive better education and better awareness around them. What do you think, Victor?
I agree with a large part of what you said, but I also think that part of the magic in IoT is being able to abstract that away. So it's getting the information as seamlessly from, let's say, what Lucas does through our product to what Christian stores, right? Because that's, as I guess like everybody's alluding to, that's where the power is, because the end operator shouldn't be an expert in IoT to reap its benefits.
Right?
Like that's how you make something useful. Is when farmers can use this technology. And yeah, in the case of Lucas, they don't have crushed pigs, right? In the case of Christian, where that information can be fed back so they can maybe optimize some aspects of the design or figure out when it might be happening to drive like useful and actionable data from it, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, folks, what a fantastic show today. And we didn't plan it this way, but we got the whole supply chain basically from, we didn't have a sensor manufacturer on the show, but Lucas talks to those people over in China, apparently. We could talk about that maybe in the break, but it's a huge space, guys. There's going to be jobs in this space for a long, long time, just as he mentioned a moment ago. So there's a lot of, there's a tremendous amount of value. I mean, and think of drones too as another target, as another endpoint out on the edge. Drones are amazingly useful for so many different reasons, folks. I'm a big agriculture guy myself. Drones flying over your property, over your land, and just gathering visual data on how brown the crop is or how green the crop is or what the soil looks like. all that stuff, where the water is flowing, as we build up maps to better understand what this land is versus what that land is, it's going to be really useful for agriculture. And that's good for everybody because we all need food. Food is pretty important. We all need for things to run properly, to run efficiently, brings costs down. Podcast bonus segment is coming up next, folks. You are listening to DM Radio. All right, folks, time for the podcast bonus segment here on DM Radio, talking all things IoT. And in the break there, I was just chatting with Lucas Funes from Weeby about drones and how amazing drones are. And folks, I have to tell you, I was impressed by them a few years ago. And I think it was 4 years ago, I was out at an event that my wife's family put on, and someone brought a drone. And it was just hovering there. And I'm looking at this thing, and I was amazed at how static it can be, even with the wind blowing or whatever, just like zzz, just hanging out. You can go up, down, all around. You can have multiple cameras on there, so you can get depth perception. So some of the better drones, they'll fly up to you. They will not hit you because they sense that you're close now and they don't want to run into something. So it depends on which version you get and what kind of software and hardware it's running and all that kind of fun stuff. But these are incredibly powerful. But Lucas, you had kind of a fun story about someone who was trying to use drones inside the store and people got scared. Tell us quickly about that.
Yeah, so there's many initiatives on how to maintain the real-time inventory on the supermarkets or stores. So one of the tests is one robot that is pointing there, and the other are putting drones in the stores, and then during the day. And then the people got scared because the drones were like flying and like doing a manual inspection, no? But it's a robot drone-driven inspection that, and said, oh, what is they are filming me, or like that, oh, my crazy. And just the drone is, if the drone could speak, would say, no, I'm not looking at you, I'm looking at the product. So that was crazy. But then, so they changed the protocol and they put it at night when nobody was there, and the drone turned on the lights and do the inspection and inventory. That was crazy.
Well, and so just to explain to the audience here, the power of these technologies, when you bring them all together, when you have drones that can just kind of cruise through your store at night and scan all the items and see what's in your store to do a task that for a human being is dreadfully, horrifyingly boring. I mean, nobody wants to do that. I could promise you no one in the retail business likes to do inventory. It is no fun. It's just brutal in terms of the time it takes and the error, the human error. So if you can have something do that automatically, that's really cool. Then you combine artificial intelligence, data management, all these different things to it. You've solved a whole heck of a lot of problems. And I'll bring Victor Volosin back in from Pervises. You folks are, again, a great intermediary to kind of extend the range of using drones in that capacity, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, not only do we do that, but our products are in some cases used in radar systems to both help augment and deconflict traffic between, let's say, human aircraft and larger drones.
No, that's cool.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty cool.
That's
one
very,
of the perks
very cool.
of the product, and what we get to do is we get to see a whole bunch of different applications, and that is actually fun, I'm sure.
We should get you back on the show sometime and just tell us about some of those things, because any place you see the intersection of one industry and another, or one technology space and another, that's where things get really interesting. Because again, you're trying to translate that data coming over the wire. I was actually talking to Christian earlier this morning about IT/OT, right? There's a company I've worked with in the past, Faircom. They have a multimodal database, and they really understood what they call impedance mismatch. There's this concept in the database space of an impedance mismatch. It's basically that this thing is coming in too hot or too slow, or it's at the wrong variation or the wrong frequency. This thing can't quite handle that properly. So how do you solve that? It's some sort of translation engine. That's IT versus OT, so information technology, operational technology. And that's a big part of where you play, right, Christian Lutz from Crate?
Yeah, absolutely. This convergence is crucial, and actually that's a huge trend that is happening. If you see what the big cloud service providers like Amazon and Azure, they are hiring all these OT guys away from these Rockwells and ABBs and all these companies, because they have to beef up their understanding and knowledge of that, and they're going to attack that and want to go in there with IT speed versus on OT. Sometimes you think you're dealing with, paralyzed slugs, you know.
That's wild. And, you know, I'll throw just one last little curveball I'll throw over to our guests. There is this really interesting dynamic with Amazon, with Google, with Microsoft to various degrees, where they are the infrastructure provider, but they're also trying to climb the stack and sell all the different things. Like in America, of course, Amazon bought Whole Foods, which is now they're competing directly with all sorts of other grocery stores, basically. But there is this concern on lots of different fronts of, okay, well, are you my partner? Are you my competitor? Or what's going on there? And I think by and large, there's going to be so much space to innovate underneath these huge players. And they can move kind of slowly, even though they're so big and have so much money. But just very quickly around the room here, Lucas, what do you think about that conflict of interest, basically, that these big cloud providers have with their customers who are delivering software as a service? What do you think, Lucas?
Well, that's a great question. In many cases, that conflict of interest needs to be approached on a complementary way. And like in our case specifically, you can think, okay, but Weavy is competitor from like Azure IoT, and not. We are leveraged that collective intelligence. They are doing a so much great job on doing infrastructure and scalability, and also like combining like with databases like Crate and that. So by doing a complementary and then bringing the added value to the end users is the key. I hear many times about that competition, like, oh, you are competing with right. AWS or Azure. I said, actually, no, what we are doing is even accelerating their deployments. So, because if you can put in the hands of the users, the power of the IoT, the AI, and everything that is being done worldwide, you can accelerate that and really solve the problem. Mm-hmm. Why? I insist in that part. Why you need to put and recreate, reinvent the wheels by putting the code again and hiring people and to rewrite the code? You just need to be complementary there. So they are like millions and billions of investment, like in the AWS, Azure, and Google, and doing the same.
Yeah, that's right.
That makes sense.
Yeah, final comment from Victor, real quick, about competition.
Competition, I think, is generally healthy. I think especially when you consider all of the different applications, allowing, again, it's a focus on the end customer, the opportunity to take advantage of this in different ways. It's a huge industry. It's an even bigger space. And, you know, it's an exciting, as you said, it's a really exciting market and avenue to be participating in.
I love it. And 30 seconds, Christian Lutz, final comments from you. Crate.io, what are your thoughts on competition with the big guys?
Yeah, it's a co-opetition in a way. There's no doubt that the cloud service providers are just excellent in providing the infrastructure. You can just not compete with that, but you have to leverage that. And this is what we do. You have to focus on a spot where you are better because you're deeper, more vertical, more focused. And then actually you can partner with them. And in our case, they're also selling us. So depending on who you talk there, they either like you because they sell you, and if it's the product guys, they hate you because you compete with some of their products. So I think that's just the way it is.
I love it. Well, folks, what a fantastic show today. We talked to Victor Volison from Pervises, Lucas Funes from Weebee, and Christian Lutz from Crate.io. Look them up online. Folks, you've been listening to DM Radio.